Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Robert T. Mann, whose new book is Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. Bob Mann holds the Manship Chair in Journalism at Louisiana State University's Manship School of Mass Communication. He spread his political wings alongside such figures as U.S. Senators Russell Long and John Brough, as well as Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco. From 2013 to 2018, he wrote a weekly column for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He's the author of books about the Civil Rights Movement, the Vietnam War, the 1964 presidential election, wartime dissent, and President Ronald Reagan. In his new book, he turns that sharp eye and political mind on his own life. It's called Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics, and what a life it is. Bob Mann, I'm so happy to welcome you back.
Thank you, Susan. It's great to be back.
Now, when you look back on your beginnings, you know, you were a preacher's kid who grew up in hard times. Are you ever surprised by where your life has taken you? Could you have imagined this life as a young person?
I guess I could say I kind of dreamed about doing something like this, but they were dreams. They didn't seem at the time maybe reasonable dreams or aspirations that I could achieve, but I did dream about it. I was fascinated by politics. I was a voracious reader of the news. My mother had to run me out of the house on afternoons because I wanted to stay inside reading the newspaper and books. I think I leaned toward politics, but no, I couldn't have imagined that I would, at such an early age, have the privilege of working for Russell Long and John Brough and having a front row seat at some pretty interesting political drama in the state and in Washington.
Now, it was part of your life early on. You were really involved in politics during college at Northeast Louisiana University.
I got involved in student government there when I got to Monroe in 1977, studying journalism. Got involved in the Student Government Association and got involved in a couple of political races, working on campus for Dave Treen when he was running for governor in 1979. And then in my summer between my freshman and sophomore year, I went back home to Leesville where I had been in high school and got involved on behalf of a Republican candidate who was running for Congress to replace Joe Wagner, who had been the Democrat who'd served for forever in that northwest part of Louisiana. And got involved in that race and kind of got, as the book describes, I got in over my head a little bit by trying to organize a parish for a Republican when the eventual winner, Buddy Leach, was from Leesville and had pretty much the support of everybody in the parish.
Well, there you go. Now, the other strand of your life was journalism. And I loved your story of doing journalism as man on the go. That was priceless. So talk a little bit about that. As a young man, Setting out in that Ford Pinto?
I worked my way through high school as a disc jockey, radio disc jockey, and then kind of leaning toward, you know, trying to find my way to get into radio news. And I guess the bridge to being a spinner of country music records into the news world was this idea that somebody had at KNOE in Monroe, this radio station where I was working, to equip my, my really sad powder blue Ford Pinto with a mobile phone, which was really unusual for the late 70s to have a mobile phone, and put these two magnetized signs on either side of the car that said "Man, M-A-N-N, on the go." And I would drive around the streets of Monroe, interviewing people on the street, doing contests where I would, you know, I would spot somebody's car driving down the road and call out their license number, and if they were listening, pull over and give them tickets to some country music show or a pro wrestling match or something. And it was kind of crazy. But I was a college student who had a, you know, in the late 70s in Monroe had a cell phone in his car. You know, it was pretty impressive to people. It just wasn't the kind of thing that people had, much less a college student.
You're ahead of your time. I mean, now some of the greats of Louisiana politics people these pages. You had some early run-ins with Edwin Edwards, one of the most colorful figures of all time, right?
Found my way to Shreveport in 1983 as the political writer for the Shreveport Journal. And I got there just in time for the 1983 governor's race when Edwin was running for a third term against Dave Treen, who was the incumbent. And my editor, Stan Tyner, assigned me to cover the Edwards campaign. It was kind of early in the summer when the race was getting going, but it wasn't a big caravan. There weren't a lot of people following Edwards or Treen around because the race wasn't really in high gear at that point. So I called up the Edwards folks and said, I'd like to start following Governor Edwards around. And the paper had just endorsed Edwards, which was really helped me a lot because he was favorable to the paper. You know, it wasn't my endorsement, but I was associated with it in that way. And so they said, sure. So, a few days later, they're in Shreveport. I can't remember if they came to Shreveport or I went to Baton Rouge. But, within a few days, I'm riding around in the back seat of a car with Edwin Edwards and a driver, spending weeks on the road with just a few of us, and just me and maybe a staff member and Edwin in the car. And it was just kind of an amazing pinch myself. Am I dreaming that I'm actually doing this and seeing what I'm seeing and hearing what I'm hearing and having this insight into a legendary political figure?
I love the way he would switch to Cajun French when he didn't want you to understand anything.
Yeah, he and his driver, they both spoke Cajun French, and so they would, we'd be riding along and they'd be talking in English, and then suddenly I would speak in French, and I knew it was something that I was not supposed to hear. And of course I didn't speak French, so I had no idea what they were talking about, but I'm sure it was some strategy. They didn't want to wind up on the front page of the Shreveport Journal the next day.
And you felt challenged by him on occasion, as if he were trying to shock you with his behavior.
You know, he was. It was all kinds of stuff about Edmund that was just, confounding, just kind of blew my mind. You know, one time I write about this in the book, that I get into the car, we were in Shreveport, and I don't remember the question that I asked him, but it annoyed him, and he just wheeled around, and he looked at me, and he just said, F you! And, in those days, maybe you could, I don't even know if you could write F you in the paper in those days, but I certainly couldn't quote that.
And so, no.
I would see a lot of other stuff that I didn't report, in the book, I kind of talk about the moral dilemma that I had, and how maybe I made some of the wrong decisions. But I saw some behavior with Edwin with women that probably today would maybe wind up in a newspaper, but in those days, maybe not. And then I read about how there was this former aide to Edwards, Clyde Vidrine, who wrote this really scandalous book called Just Taking Orders, in which he recounts all this horrible, illegal, unethical activity by Edwin. A lot of it probably not true, some of it true, I'm sure. But people would come up to Edwards and hand this book to him that purported to chronicle all of his criminality, and Edwards would just smile and take the book and sign it and hand it back to him. And it was just, none of what I saw about Edwin Edwards then or now really makes any sense.
That's one of the most hilarious things I find about Louisiana, is that people who are the subject of the biographies will sign the biographies.
Right,
and
right.
This was the case for you with your book about Russell Long.
Yeah, when I wrote the first book I wrote was a biography about Long, and we did several signings where he would come to the signing for my book, and people really wanted his signature more than mine, so he would be the first person they would hand the book to, and he had this funny little habit of writing with profound admiration.
So
he would write to Bill with profound admiration, Russell Long, and he would just hand the book to me. And so I was like, I can't really improve on that. So
I'll
just scribble my name below his.
Save some time. Now, he was one of your great mentors. When you went to work for him, you were 26 and he was 66. And you were almost on the hot seat immediately.
Well, within about 6 weeks after I went to Washington to work for him, that he calls me to his office one morning, late morning. I'd gone up there to work for him with the anticipation that he would be running for re-election in about a year and a half. And so I was planning on working for him for about a year or so in Washington, then moving back and working on the campaign in Baton Rouge. And so I get called into his office. I didn't know him very well, 6 weeks on his staff. And he says, he and his chief of staff were sitting there, and he says, Bob, I just want to let you know that I've decided I'm not running for re-election. And I thought, but they were playing a joke on me just to see if I had the gumption to argue with him. I don't know why I thought that, but so I started to argue with him, and, you know, Chris Kirkpatrick, who was his chief of staff, put his hand on my forearm to kind of say, no, this is for real, or this is really happening. And so, you know, within the afternoon, I was organizing a press conference so Long could announce his retirement, and that was quite a circus that day.
What a shock, too. What a shock. And then you went to work for John Breaux, and that was a very different kind of office.
It was. You know, and I had the experience of spending the last hour or two of Russell Long's 38 years in the Senate with him in his office with a number of other staff members. We just hung out with him in that office that morning. Mm-hmm. It was a Saturday morning. And at noon, he was no longer a U.S. Senator. And so he walks, you know, we said goodbye to him, and he and Carol and his wife walked down the hall. And I turned around and walked to the Dirksen building, which was next door to the Russell Senate office building, and began working for John Breaux. So, I had the distinction of working for two U.S. senators, being employed by two U.S. senators on the same day. But it was a completely different experience. I mean, you know, Breaux was beginning his career in the Senate and had a tremendous amount of energy and drive and ambition. And, you know, Long, the last 2 years of working for Long were really, you know, sort of shutting down a Senate office.
I love the story of that last day when Russell Long took the key out of his pocket to his office and kissed it.
Yeah,
before he handed it off.
Sweet moment.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet moment.
There are lots of sweet moments like that in this book. And because I think you make a real effort to humanize all these politicians.
Well, I tried to. After all, they really are humans with a lot of foibles and a lot of quirks, and which, you know, I think applies to all of us, me included. But yeah, I mean, I wanted people not to just see them as political leaders and politicians, but as the humans that they are. And I was, you know, I was really, really fortunate. A lot of people don't have this experience working for as many politicians that I do, that you never get anybody who's a jerk or expects you to do unethical tasks for them or is mm-hmm. demanding and demeaning in some way. I was just really lucky that everybody that I worked for was a decent human being.
Well, for New Orleans readers, one of the most gut-wrenching chapters will be the tales of Governor Blanco and Katrina. And some of the most painful passages are in that section of the book. And I think you do a lot to dispel what people thought was happening and tell them what was really happening.
Well, I tried to. I think pretty confident that my book is the first book written by a member of Governor Blanco's staff about the events of that day. Not that other people haven't given interviews about those events, but I felt like that I was probably going to be the only or certainly the first person to sit down and write comprehensively about what was going on behind the scenes on the governor's staff. And I felt like it was my chance to, you know, to maybe set the record straight on a number of areas where I think that she and the state in general got a bad rap by the national and sometimes state and local media about the way that Governor Blanco handled Katrina. But I wanted people to also see the humanity, as you mentioned earlier, of Kathleen Blanco and how she never gave up. She was as committed as anybody I've ever seen to not only doing the job, but finishing the job. You know, even after she knew she was not running for re-election, and she could have easily, you know, checked out and gone off and done other things, she stayed on the job till the very last day, giving it her all, and I think helped make it a better life for a lot of people in the New Orleans area because of her commitment to continuing to do the job and never give up.
Well, I think you illuminate the forces arrayed against her, you know, and how hard she worked in that difficult situation, too. I admire her a lot. Now, two other strands run through this book. One is your conversion from Republican to Democrat. So talk a little bit about that. Remember, there was a time when journalists didn't actually talk much about their party affiliations.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in a pretty politically conservative household, and mm-hmm. I see this in my students here at LSU, that they, you know, they come to college or they, you know, their early adulthood, they're still very much reflecting their parents' politics, and that's certainly what I did. And then I see where college is the first time that a lot of them are faced with the diversity of political views and just diversity of different opinions and people that really begins to cause them to maybe reassess what they believe or start to believe what they believe and not what their parents believe. And that certainly happened to me in college. And I had people in my life, college professors, some people that I who, and there was one that I write about, Dave Norris, who was my economics professor in college, who became the mayor of West Monroe, and I was the reporter for the Monroe New Star World assigned to cover West Monroe City Hall, and he really influenced my view of the world, particularly the way that I looked at and still look at people who are down and out, who need what we would then have called welfare, but just need public assistance, need government help to get their lives back together and get back on their feet. And I admit that I wasn't all that sympathetic to people with that plight, but Dave really challenged me and pushed me to look at them through different eyes. And I write about in the book going and sitting in the local welfare office in Monroe one morning and just sitting there for a few hours and just watching and listening to people's plights and their situations, and how it really kind of cracked open my heart in a way to people who are down and out. And it's, I guess I should have written more about this from the standpoint of how could it be that someone like me, who grew up in, very modest circumstances with parents who had a lot of financial problems, didn't have more sympathy for people who were facing sometimes the same challenges that my family faced.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thread that runs through the book is your life as a writer. And, you were steadily building this career, and you did it quite wisely. And you started with that book about Russell Long.
I knew someone was going to write a book about him, and I knew that I knew that would be the way that I could probably get him to cooperate with me, is that he would maybe trust me. Mm-hmm. He and I had worked together on this speech that he gave about his father, Huey Long, on the anniversary, on the 50th anniversary of his father's assassination in September of 1985. We worked pretty well together. I did a lot of I interviewed him a lot to help him put this speech together, and we had a good rapport, and he was willing to work with me. And having the cooperation of somebody like that when you're writing a book, it helped me sell the book to a publisher. Mm-hmm. It enabled me to finish the book, and it opened all kinds of doors for me in the publishing world after that, because the hardest thing to do is to complete a book. A lot of people think they can write a book, and they can even get a contract to write a book, but actually completing the book is not as easy as it seems. Mm-hmm. And that you can do it gives publishers the confidence that you can do it again. And it really opened all kinds of doors for me and enabled me to have this very happy life that I've had writing.
Well, and you did it with an eye toward a career in academe, that you wanted to become a teacher.
Yeah, I did. I just knew that I wanted to do this for a long time. And as soon as I could, even when I was working for John Brough, I persuaded the folks here at my school where I now teach full time to give me a course to teach as an adjunct, because I really wanted to do this work, and I thought I could be good at it. And it really was a great introduction to the academic life, because I knew immediately this was the life that I really wanted, and it was something that I thought I had some gifts, and I think I do.
One of the things about this book that struck me is that it's so honest and it's so self-deprecating, especially about some of the things you regret the most. You dedicate this book to a friend of yours with whom you had a falling out, and that must have been a very hard thing to write about.
Well, it was. It really was. I resolved in the beginning of when I started doing this that I was not going to make myself the hero of the story, because I think that was honest. But I didn't start out thinking I was going to devote so much of the book to my mistakes. But as I went through it, it became almost kind of like therapy for me to do that. And I'm glad that I did it for a lot of reasons, because I think it's helped me repair my own damaged psyche over some of the mistakes and really awful things that I did that hurt people. I hope that it is a warning, that there are a lot of warnings in this book for how easy it is to lose your way in politics and public affairs. Without giving the story away, I betrayed a friend who was fighting cancer, and he died within the year, and I never saw him again. We had no communication that last year of his life, and until the very end when he granted me grace enough to forgive me for what I had done to him. It's something that I think about every day. I don't ever not think about what I did. And I hope that the book, was for him and his wife and his son, mm-hmm. but also for me. And there's been a lot of healing that's come out of that. I've shared the book with his wife and his son, and they've been so generous and embracing the book and accepting my continued, repentance for what I did. And so it's been a wonderful experience to bear my soul in that way.
Well, and you take it a step further with Governor Buddy Romer, too. You make right. a public apology to him.
Well, I owed it to him. You know, in the book, I describe in pretty great detail about some of the awful things that I did and said about Buddy in the 1995 governor's race when I was working for the Democratic Party. And we began to, you know, a few years later, we began to run into each other at church and at bookstores around Baton Rouge and just, you know, kind of struck up a little bit of a friendship. He didn't seem to hold it against me, and it kind of confused me a little bit. And so
this being Louisiana, it kind of confused.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I invited him to come speak to my class in the fall of 2008. And I thought, well, you know, this is the time to, if I'm going to apologize, I might as well do it in person and show and sort of model that behavior for my students.
So
Before I introduced him, I apologized to him in front of all my students. And it was, you know, it strengthened our friendship. We saw each other a lot in the last few years before he died. I regret that the pandemic made it so that we couldn't see each other. But I saw him almost every week. At the Barnes & Noble, where I've spent a lot of time writing this book, I wrote the chapter about him with him sitting on the other side of the room.
So what did writing this book do for you as a writer? I mean, you've taken on some tough topics, some interesting political figures, but what did it do for you to write about yourself? Did it close some doors that you were happy to close?
I didn't start out, like I said, to make it about self-therapy. I just had a lot of good stories that I wanted to tell that I thought that shouldn't die with me. And it's maybe brought about in me a desire to write another memoir and maybe look for other areas of my life where I can explore, because it was, to me, so revealing. I thought I was going to be telling other people about my life and my experiences, but I ended up telling myself a lot about myself and learning a lot about myself. And it made me think that maybe there's more to tell, and maybe I won't publish it. Maybe no one else will want to read it, but I think it might be good for me. So I'm very open and thinking about what I want to do if I write another memoir. But I do think that I have some stories maybe to tell myself. So, and maybe it just involves journaling, being more determined and, you know, disciplined about journaling.
You refer every now and then to the notes that you kept and the journals. You must have had a sense that all this would be useful someday.
Yeah, I guess I did. You know, I don't remember thinking about, I'm going to write a book about this someday, but for some reason, I did write a lot of stuff down in real time and held on to it. So there must have been something in the back of my mind that said, hold on to this. You might be able to use it someday. I'm glad I did.
Well, you put it to good use in this book, I got to tell you. So,
thanks.
We've been talking with Bob Mann, whose new book is Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics. It's an up-close and personal witness to history. You can meet him Saturday, August 21st from 11 to 1 at Barnes & Noble in Metairie, or Saturday, August 28th from noon to 2 at Barnes & Noble in Harvey. Bob, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. And just a reminder, with evolving COVID restrictions, best to check with venues before attending in-person events, and be sure to mask up when you do. Here in New Orleans, the Octavia Books Book Club is discussing Jody Picou's Small Great Things, Saturday, August 21st at 10:30 a.m. Bob Mann discusses and signs Backrooms and Bayous, My Life in Louisiana Politics, Saturday, August 21st from 11 to 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie, and again Saturday, August 28th from noon to 2 at Barnes & Noble in Harvey. Tubby & Coo's Mid-City Bookshop is sponsoring a virtual romance day, August 21st and 22nd. There will be a virtual book fair and a panel featuring Sharon Lynn Fisher, author of The Warrior Poet, Everina Maxwell, Winter's Orbit, Jesse Mihalik, Chaos Reigning, and Elizabeth Lim, Six Crimson Cranes, Sunday, August 22nd at 1. Register at tubbyandcoos.com. L.F. Ranner discusses and signs her novel Sailing to Byzantium, Sunday, August 22nd at 3 at Octavia Books. Bruce Spicer, a New Orleans lawyer and internationally recognized Beatles authority, will discuss the fourth book in his album series, The Beatles Finally Let It Be, Monday, August 23rd at 6, via video conference online. Visit jplibrary.net/adults for more details, including how to join this discussion. Marissa Nathan-Gerson discusses and signs her memoir, Forget Prayers, Bring Cake, A Single Woman's Guide to Grieving, Tuesday, August 24th from 6 to 7 at the Broad Theater. Please pre-order books at octaviabooks.com. Maurice Carlos Ruffin discusses and signs The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, Tuesday, August 24th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books, and again Tuesday, August 31st at 6 at Octavia Books. James Lee Burke appears in a virtual conversation with Colette Bancroft, Thursday, August 26th at 6, sponsored by Garden District Bookshop. Go to GardenDistrictBookshop.com for tickets. Jonathan Santlofer discusses his book, The Last Mona Lisa, with Tom Piazza, Thursday, August 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. And congratulations to Mona Lisa Saloy, the new Louisiana State Poet Laureate. Her first book, Red Beans and Ricely Yours, won the T.S. Eliot Prize and the Pan Oakland Josephine Miles Award. Her second book is Second Line Home. Mona Lisa is a New Orleans native, an author, folklorist, and educator who teaches at Dillard University. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.